Welcome back to another episode of A Desi Woman Podcast. I am your host, Sonia Gokhale, and the voices I am seeking may have never been heard before, but their stories deserve to be told. What is a Desi woman? She is a dynamic, fearless, and strong woman. She is your mother, your grandmother, your daughter, your sister. She is every one of us who is on an endless pursuit of self-empowerment and fulfillment. I am Sonia Gokhale, and I am a Desi woman.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of A Desi Woman Podcast. I am your host, Sonia Gokhale, and today I am so delighted to be joined by author and professor, Dr. Durba Mitra. Dr. Mitra is an assistant professor of women, gender, and sexuality in the Harvard Faculty of Arts and Sciences and the Carol K. Forstheimer Assistant Professor at the Radcliffe Institute. Dr. Mitra works at the intersection of feminist and queer studies. Her scholarship analyzes the history of sexuality in the Global South, histories of science and social science, and the politics of gender in the colonial and post-colonial world. Dr. Mitra received her PhD from Emory University. Her research has been supported by a fellowship at Wolf Humanities Center at the University of Pennsylvania and a Fulbright Nehru Student Research Fellowship to India. She is the author of critically acclaimed Indian Sex Life, Sexuality, and Colonial Origins of Modern Social Thought. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mitra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Mitra, your latest book, Indian Sex Life, Sexuality and the Colonial Origins of Modern Social Thought, carefully elucidates how British colonial men and Indian male social scientists use their positions to socially ostracize and oppress Indigenous Indian women, who they felt did not fit into the extremely narrow social mold that they deemed acceptable at the time, namely being an upper caste married Hindu woman. You utilize a host of archival sources from India and around the world to show that women who fell outside of this narrow definition of acceptability were labeled prostitutes. Just to be clear, this is such a pivotal and significant insight, as your book essentially offers accounts of how British officers, medical practitioners, ethnologists, elite Bengali sociologists, and even fiction writers at the time saw almost all Indian women as prostitutes, whether they were Hindu widows, married women from lower caste communities, Muslim married women, women running away from their husbands, women deserted by their husbands. No matter, they were all defined as sexually deviant and prostitutes by the colonial powers that be and their Indian cohorts. So my first question for you is, can you elaborate on this rather shocking discovery in your book and outline for us some of the systemic issues that were at play at the time?
Absolutely. Thank you, first of all, for this wonderful question and for having me. It's such a pleasure to speak to you and to speak to an audience across like a range of geographies and spaces about this book and the kind of work and kind of questions that I'm doing in my scholarship, but also in my public advocacy work. You mentioned that when, what is this kind of stunning revelation that became the kind of major foundation of the book. So when I began the project, I thought that I was going to do a history of different communities, of different women, of the many types of women who maybe fell into prostitution because of class problems, because they were excluded by their families, because they fell out of marriages. And so in order to do this research, I knew it was a historical project. And so I began to go to archives all over, first in India, in places like Delhi, in Calcutta, in London, here in the United States, in Harvard University libraries, University of Pennsylvania libraries, Chicago. And I followed this archival category, the prostitute, across these a wide range of archives. What I found when I started to go through these archives was that the category, this concept, prostitute, was everywhere across a huge range of places, archives of medicine, archives of sociology, as you mentioned, but also archives of law, and then archives of literature and novels and autobiographies supposedly written by women. And in those texts, this category, this idea of the prostitute kept appearing and then disappearing and then reappearing in texts that seemingly had very little to do with prostitution. She was kind of all over. She appeared in the analysis of social life writ large. In fact, the prostitute seemed to describe virtually all women outside of monogamous upper caste marriage. And you mentioned some of them, but you know, the categories that one would associate with it now would be something like the courtesan or the waif or the devadasi, the so-called dancing girl, a Hindu widow who is seen as sexually promiscuous or not abiding by the kind of social death that she was supposed to do, and certain polygamous women, particularly Muslim women who practiced polygamy, and then, of course, working women, women who were in public spaces, working in industries, and then servant women, household women who were working inside the home. All of these women were seen as sexually in excess. And by seen, I mean both by colonial officials, a colonial state that was increasingly interested in intervening in Indian social life in the everyday, and also by an increasing number of Indian men who were educated in colonial institutions, colonial universities, who began to write about the reform and revision of Indian society under colonial rule. And so the question for me was, why is this category, prostitute, and these ideas about women's sexuality appearing everywhere? How could I account for that appearance of this idea everywhere? It seemed that something systematic was happening, but I didn't know how to fully account for it. And then I went back to the drawing board and I realized, actually, the story here is not really about the fact that the prostitute was everyone and everything, but rather that there was a kind of systematic attempt at controlling and erasing women's desires and women's sexuality through this concept of the prostitute. That men, in fact, began to use this concept as a foundation to imagine theories of a patriarchal society. And to understand this presence, I needed to have a different way of reading that linked all of these different structures and forms that sought to control and erase women's sexuality. And so that different way of thinking becomes the kind of main argument of the book, which is that ideas about women's sexuality, this idea that I call female sexual deviancy, sits at the heart or the foundation of how we write and think about the progress of Indian society, both in the colonial officials and then by Indian men. And this is a legacy that even after the end of colonialism is something that we live with, because we so often see the control of female sexuality as essential to being good, proper citizens. So that gives a sense of, that's some of the ways that I tried to solve for this problem. But it's funny, once you start seeing the control of women's sexuality, it's hard to unsee it. And that's one of the things that's really striking in writing the book, is that you start to, like in contemporary everyday conversations today, you realize how often women are policed for their sexuality. And that has a long legacy. And that's really what this book is trying to write about.
Well, thank you so much for that response. And my next question for you is, Indian sex life is very much focused upon the colonial period through its end in the 1940s. But the reach of this project is so much broader. And I would argue that it is unquestionably important, and it resonates with urgent issues for women in modern India and the present conditions of sexual control and violence that continue to endure in the country. My next question for you is a complex one. Are we still at a point in society where the erasure of women's desires and sexuality continues to be seen as a natural and inevitable fact of everyday life in post-colonial India and other societies?
I mean, I think in academic terms, I always say, I use a phrase that scholars who think in terms of the political questions that drive their work, that I'm writing a history of the present. These are present day concerns and present day issues that we live with, that I certainly know firsthand as a woman. of course, American born, but a person who's done extensive research in India, which we can certainly talk about, you know, that has experienced the kind of policing both in the diaspora and among my Indian family, has seen other women experience policing around their sexualities, know it kind of personally and viscerally. You know, in your body, you know that kind of policing is happening in everyday experiences when you go in any urban setting in India. And so how can we think about these questions, you know, resonating today? I think absolutely. We can see them in all kinds of endemic issues. Today, for example, there is no question that there is a crisis around sexual violence in contemporary India. And we see this most recently in this extraordinarily violent Hathras rape case that happened in UP. And it was unfortunately it's a deeply sad case of a rape of a young Dalit girl, and the extraordinary violence, both state and social, that was enacted on her and her family, both beforehand as a Dalit woman and after she passes away in the aftermath against her family, and the kind of caste enforcement of violence that happens through the control and the erasure again of women's sexuality. I think that, you know, we see this a lot in terms of caste subordination and atrocities that fall along caste lines. But we also see this in terms of more broadly endemic issues of sexual violence, right? We can think of the Delhi rape case in 2012, and then the aftermath of the Delhi rape case, where, you know, the discussion in the Delhi rape case really was, you know, it leads to these massive protests, but the massive protests really focused on how should we, you know, punish the perpetrators of this rape, rather than thinking about changing a culture of sexual violence that is so pervasive in contemporary India. And so that's just one example of one way. I mean, I think that we can see this in all kinds of other much more everyday quotidian experiences of the control of female sexuality, whether we are talking about a Bollywood actress and the way in which we police and think about Bollywood actresses today. We see that a lot in our contemporary moment. We see it in everyday experiences in our households. The control of women's sexuality is so critical to the way we comport ourselves. And I was thinking about that as I spoke to you about this project and we were thinking about this interview, you know, the kinds of ways that my mom, who is an incredibly progressive woman, was still policing me in ways that she didn't maybe intend to, or other women relatives certainly did, where I realized that even today when I expose a certain part of my leg, or, you know, I wear a sleeveless top, and, you know, I'm American born. And even then I can feel the visceral experience of the control of sexuality in my everyday experience. And so, I mean, we can go from systemic issues of sexual violence and also homophobia and the way the idea of marriage and heterosexual reproduction organizes Indian society, all the way down to the experiences that you have and I have, that I know we have, of the way we think about our bodies in particular ways, and the way we try to comport ourselves, and the way we think what it means to be proper and what it means to be appropriate. I think about those things all of the time. They're kind of in my mind. And so we can think from systemic to the personal. And I think that's the legacy that I'm really writing about.
Well, thank you so much for that detailed response. And my next question for you pertains to the very unique challenges that you faced in researching this book and the scattered, fragmented archival stories that you pursued globally. I was very struck by the particular obstacles that you faced as a female researcher of this period in India, since most of the archives that you sought had been moved out of Indian libraries or archives due to the nature of colonialism. You were often refused access to libraries and archives and were constantly asked why you were conducting research on such quote-unquote distasteful topics. You faced harassment and had to be mindful of your physical safety. And to add to all of this, you were also acutely aware of the ethical issues entailed with your research. What does it mean to find an account of an Indian woman's autopsy in a medical library in London or New York, totally moved from its place of production? So I wanted to ask you if you could share your thoughts on the experience of research as a female researcher and researching subjects and women throughout colonial India whose only voice is what you found in documentation.
Absolutely. It's funny because there's so many dilemmas. I mean, the first I would say, so we could think of it in two ways. One, I would say, is dismemberment. And there's two kinds of dismemberment that really organized this book. The first is the dismemberment of archives. That is what you mentioned right away at the beginning of your amazing question, which was about the movement of materials from the place of their origin. So an archival material or a book that I would find in New York City at the public library or here at Harvard's library, but I couldn't find in Calcutta, even though that's actually where the book was produced. And that kind of dismemberment is a defining feature of colonialism. What we know and what our scholars of gender and sexuality argue vehemently is that colonialism was always a knowledge project. That is to say, colonialism wasn't simply about extracting resources or ruling over people. It was also about creating knowledge about those people. And this is a kind of really important classical argument that a scholar, Edward Said, makes in a very important book that he publishes in 1979, Orientalism. And what he argues, and then the scholarship that follows really demonstrates, is that there's a kind of dismemberment of knowledge forms, knowledge structures, of libraries that happens and that is critical to the colonial project. So, for example, when the British began to take over territory in the 18th century especially, we hear about, for example, Tipu Sultan's library being moved all the way out from India. And we hear this a lot, especially related to early Indian materials, Sanskrit materials, Persian materials, which are systematically taken from local libraries all over India and then moved to Germany, moved to London, moved to Oxford, moved to eventually New York City or to Yale University. And the justification was that they were objects to be studied. They were forms of scholarship. But of course, what we know is when you move that object, and it, especially before the digital era that we live in now, and I can talk a little bit more about the digital era, what we know is that even though there is a presence of that object is no longer present for the people for whom the object was produced. You know, the oral traditions, the traditions of passing down text and manuscripts, that dismemberment kind of ruins a tradition. And the movement of those materials creates a barrier for people within the subcontinent to write their own histories. And one of the things that's really striking then is that to write the book, I had to go all over in order to just assemble basic archives, you know, to try to answer or to create fragments across different spaces. And so the most, you know, common archive that one would go to is the British Library, which what used to be the British Museum, where the Colonial Office not only, you know, collected all of the documents related to the governance of colonial India, but also collected what they called vernacular language materials. That is, every published book they surveilled and collected copies of. And so the best preserved books in Bengali, in Hindi, in Urdu, actually often appear in London, but are not available in good condition in India. And so that dissonance or that dismemberment became part of how I began to think about the book, that movement of objects and materials. And, you know, that speaks to my privilege. I have an American passport, and obviously up until COVID, I could move across spaces. I had some financial resources because of being in research institutions that I could move and see these materials. But one of the things you see is that when you go to India, scholars who are in India cannot move the same way that I can. And scholars who are in India, but for example, want to study, let's say, medieval areas or areas of the subcontinent that now fall in Pakistan or areas that fall in Bangladesh, they may not get the visa to do so. But as an American, I was able to go to Bangladesh. I was able to go to Pakistan. I was able to go to India. And those privileges allowed me to write the book. But that framework, that thinking of dismemberment also kind of organized how I thought about the content of the book. And you mentioned that in the book, I talk about autopsies of women. In the chapter, there's a chapter in the book called Circularity, which looks at medical evidence of women who are accused of committing abortions. And that chapter is really interested in how we narrate women into an archive. How do we ethically imagine women's lives when they appear to us only in terms of their bodies? And I tell the story of, in particular, one case, a woman named Kali, or named by the archive as Kali, whose life only comes to us. And I call her a woman. She's not really a woman. She's a girl. She's a girl who appears in the archive. And the only reason she appears is because there's a coroner writing a report, doing an autopsy of her body and writing a report about it. So really, her entire life is distilled through the evidence of her body. And what we find is that she died of an alleged abortion. She died at a very young age. She died after being widowed at the age of 11, and then became pregnant after being widowed. And, you know, we don't know the circumstances of her pregnancy. She may have experienced sexual violence, for example. In fact, she may have experienced intimate partner or familial violence. And from the circumstance, it certainly sounds like there was some kind of coercion because she was just a child. And she becomes pregnant, and then somewhere along the way, she procures an abortion, and then she dies of that abortion because no one is taking care of her. She becomes visibly pregnant, and her family kicks her out, her in-laws. She goes to her own family. They refuse to take her in, and then she dies alone. And the coroner describes her as the kind of pitiable condition of Indian womanhood, that this is what happens to widows because no one cares about widows. And this is why we as colonial officials should be here to kind of civilize these people from the way they treat their widows. But we get these kind of fragments of a life. She had a sister. She had aspirations. She imagined possibilities for herself. She tried to get an abortion so that she didn't have a child out of wedlock. And yet all of those are foreclosed because she eventually dies. And so that story, I think, poses a lot of ethical problems for a scholar. It's, first of all, deeply affecting. You know, it's hard to read. You sit in an archive and it's dusty and you're alone and you're sitting there and you're reading these cases. And the cases are coming to you in a medical textbook or an autopsy report. They're not supposed to affect you emotionally. But ultimately what happens is that you do get affected emotionally because you're bearing witness to a young girl who died and who no one helped her. And what I try to do in the book is try to think affectively with emotion about those circumstances, and such that the dismemberment that is part of her autopsy, the dismemberment that's part of her archiving, the movement of those materials from India to other places in the world, that for a moment we can take a breath to imagine the circumstance of her life, but also think about how limited it is and how sad it is that her life entered an archive and it was only told to us because she died. Why wasn't it that we learned about this girl's life in life? Why is it that we only learn about her in death? So that's the dismemberment side of it. And then I think there is the side, which is the last part of the question, which is about what does it mean to be a female researcher? You know, this is a hard question. You know, I'm an American. And so when I would do research in India, of course, no matter how many braids I would wear, and of course, I was always in a salwar kameez or a sari, especially in Calcutta. And no matter how much I tried to pass, there was something about my accent and my Bengali and my way of being that people always knew I was not from there. And so I stood out. And so, for example, when I'd go to libraries, certainly the library where I found the case of Kali, you know, I was always asked, why would a nice girl like you want to study a subject as, you know, as abhorrent, as kind of dirty as this subject? Why are you interested in this? You know, such a strange thing. And that came up again and again. You know, in one of the archives, I remember it was, you know, monsoon season in Calcutta where it gets incredibly wet. You know, like there are, you know, inches of rain that sit on the ground, especially in the old part of Calcutta. And I wore capri pants to the archive in part to make sure that the bottom of my pants didn't get wet. And the archivist kicked me out because she could see my ankles. And so, you know, which is crazy, right? You know, like I wasn't even wearing a sleeveless shirt, which is, you know, like another thing.
Yeah.
And so that's like one. And then of course you have the other, which is like the more dangerous kind. So like I can name, you know, doing research in the city of Delhi. I was a poor PhD student. I mostly took public transportation when I was doing, you know, these 2 years of research. And in Delhi, when you take an auto rickshaw, you know, you say you want to go from point A to point B and you're kind of at the will of the rickshaw driver. And I remember once I was going to an archive, it had gotten dark. I was coming back and the rickshaw driver, you know, pulled over in a place that I didn't know and I ran. And I can name those circumstances. I can name other circumstances where, you know, someone, you know, the kind of circumstances that every woman I know who has conducted research in many parts of the world, not only in India, certainly here, even here in the United States, you know, where someone grabs your breast, where someone makes a remark, where people are staring at you in a way that you know you're in danger. That's an everyday experience of doing research. And I think about that every time I think about, I pick up a book written by a woman, the immense amount of personal endurance that it requires to do the research, let alone the kind of scholarly work and the intellectual work and the research. You know, you have to comport yourself. You have to think about how to protect yourself. I wore a backpack all through my research for the years that I did research in India, in part because in certain spaces, I could turn the backpack on the front of my body so that no one would grab my breasts. And that should not be the circumstance in which you do research, but that's the reality of what it is.
That is incredible. No, I've traveled through India and I concur with you. Unfortunately, that is indeed the state of affairs. And, you know, I was getting chills when you were talking about the autopsy and the woman in your book, because I just interviewed Priyanka Dubé, a BBC reporter based in Delhi, and her book details modern day India autopsies of rape and murder victims throughout India. And so it absolutely has a relevance to modern day India. And it's just so shocking and sad that exactly what you've described is something that a researcher is currently doing in India today.
I mean, Dubé's book is extraordinary. I teach it in my classes. I think it's the best reporting that we have of these prevalent crimes of sexual violence, of femicide, of the killing of women that are very difficult to document. I mean, the extraordinary risk that she had to take in order to do that research, I have such immense respect for that work, in part because the risks are also these, you know, communities, people don't want this spoken about. There's so much danger in speaking the truth of these circumstances. You know, the other research, major research project that I've done with a dear colleague of mine, a legal scholar, his name is Mrinal Satish. He studies rape law in India. We did an extensive research project on the use of medical evidence in rape cases in India from the 1950s until today, basically. And, you know, one of the things we found over and over again was the way in which ideas about women's sexuality, particularly women's chastity, their virginity, came to bear on the outcome of these rape cases, often in very negative ways, that men would be acquitted from accusations of rape because supposedly the medical evidence demonstrated that a woman was habituated to sexual intercourse. And Dubé does a great job of also documenting that work. So you can see there's lots of continuity in this in a kind of deeply sad way.
It's incredible. It really is. My next question for you is, in researching this show, I reviewed your past interviews both at Harvard and in a global context, and you are quite candid in offering that many of the intellectual questions that you ask, whether it be through your published work or archival and academic research, are a direct result of the conversations you've had with women on their experiences of social judgment, subordination, and their efforts to challenge strict social norms. And on a somewhat related note, you also revealed that no one has influenced you more than your own mother, who arrived in the United States in the 1980s as an immigrant from India to earn a PhD in statistics while working a full-time job and raising two children on her own. Can you share more about these powerful influences in your life and the connection to your groundbreaking work?
I can think of nothing more than these interactions that I have with women, everyday interactions that I have with women, whether it was in a kitchen in Calcutta or on the street where a woman would protect me on a bus, or people like my mother, or watching my mother and my grandmother. Those are the everyday quotidian experiences that help me shape my research questions. You know, first I'll talk about my mom. You know, my mother came to the United States in 1982, and she came, you know, in great secrecy because she was leaving an abusive marriage. And it's really striking. I've started to write more about this actually recently because of the COVID epidemic, about domesticity and domestic violence. And, you know, she was an upper caste woman, at least educated enough to get a visa eventually to come to the US. And she came here and eventually raised, as you mentioned, two kids, me and my brother, by herself, basically, while working a full-time job, sometimes two. And she did it in defiance of a social circumstance that would have had her stay in her abusive marriage. Stay in abusive marriages as a whole, because it was seen as socially proper. And what one of the things that I've realized as I've started to do this research on the idea of domestic violence, and I've started to do this research during this COVID pandemic, because we see in this moment the extraordinary rise of domestic violence incidents all over the world. In fact, the World Health Organization identified it very early in the pandemic as a problem. In a place like India, you know, it's a pandemic itself. Domestic violence and domestic violence incidents increased, you know, tenfold. And my mom, you know, was also leaving an extraordinarily violent circumstance. And at the time, there were no laws in 1982 against domestic violence in India. And so one of the things that has been interesting for me is to look back, what existed in 1982? What kind of work did feminists start to do in the late 70s that eventually culminates in domestic violence laws, first in the mid-1980s, a few years after my mom left, and then again in the early 2000s with revised domestic violence laws? What kinds of work did feminists, did women have to do to organize for their own rights and for their own dignity in the face of a state and in the face of families, including women within families, that increasingly felt that women should stay within violent situations and within domestic kinship structures? And that to me has been really striking, that, you know, if COVID happened in 1982, when my mom was still, you know, in the early 80s, when my mom was still in this kind of forced marriage and where she had nowhere to go, she would be literally incarcerated, locked down into a circumstance that constantly threatened her life. And so that's just, you know, it gives you a sense, like, there was a kind of ability for her to leave one circumstance and the kind of social structures and social disciplining that was part of that circumstance to come here to get a PhD by herself. She worked so hard. And that circumstance of thinking about that migration and what she had to leave behind, her family, her friends, including actually, she was already doing a PhD. She had to leave all of that behind in order to escape that circumstance. And you know, how do we think about these questions of domestic violence here in the US? You know, this is an ongoing problem within South Asian diasporic communities. You know, how do we help think about protecting women? How many of us know of women who, you know, there's that family that you know when you were growing up? I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, and there was one family we knew that there was domestic violence happening in the household, but no one said anything. And my mother was this exceptional person who would let those women come and stay in our house. She often had women coming and staying when they had difficult circumstances at home. She was the person who gave them money or gave them a different place to go and gave them safety or took their children when they needed to go elsewhere. And that's the uniqueness of my mother. She had an immense strength. She has an immense strength. But, you know, that's shaped. So now, you know, I'm writing on domesticity and domestic violence. But for this book, you know, I remember the judgment. Because my mother was a divorced woman, I remember the feeling within diasporic communities that she, as a divorced woman, was more sexually promiscuous. And this is like a middle-aged woman with two children who would cook a meal, and people would act weirdly around her if she were near their husbands. And that's just a personal experience. But, you know, those questions and seeing her kind of socially ostracized by her family in India, by communities here in the United States, that experience made me have a really kind of detailed understanding of the way social exclusion and social control works. It happens in glances, and it happens in whispers. It happens in networks of gossip. It happens in silence and shame. And that is the kind of, those are the categories that I began to research as a scholar. Silence, shame. How do we write a history for these ideas?
Well, I cannot believe that our time is already at an end. And I do want to ask you this. Do you have a book in the works or any other new research that you have on the horizon for any of your fans?
I do. So I mentioned a little bit of it. I'm now, you know, the first book has got a lot of sad topics and it's got a lot of sad themes. And so now I'm kind of writing a book about the 1970s and 80s and thinking about feminist dreams. You know, I'm thinking about how did feminists try to remake the world when they started to have massive political movements in to revise rape law, to create new laws around domestic violence, to create a new vision of society where women could work, where women could have access to education, where women had choice in marriage, you know, where women had an imagination of freedom. And so I've started to do a kind of experimental work around this, the dreams and imaginations of women. And that's the kind of ongoing work that I've been writing about now.
That sounds absolutely amazing. I cannot wait to hear more about that. And, you know, I again want to ask every listener to please pick up Dr. Mitra's book, Indian Sex Life, Sexuality, and the Colonial Origins of Modern Social Thought. And especially for myself, I can only say it's just been a profound experience. And even more so when I think about the fact that you are one of the only people in the entire world doing this kind of research because of the dismemberment, as you've indicated, of archives and just the fact that, yeah, very few people can do this. So thank you again so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure. And I should just say, you know, I build on a long tradition of feminists being strong-minded women that are scholarly, that are activists. And I'm just really glad to be part of that tradition, including someone like you, Sonia. So it's really a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Such an honor, really, to have you here.
Thank you.